Good afternoon. Happy Sunday. Welcome to the first episode of Meet the Hollywood Press. I am your host, Joseph Capsch. And just to give you a little background on what we're doing here, we're going to be gathering a panel of journalists from around the Hollywood industry each Sunday. And we're going to let you in on those conversations that happen, not, you know, before the story, after the story, in the newsroom, at a cocktail party. And we're sort of going to let you guys in on those conversations here in our studio. I want to preface something before I get pummeled on Twitter, because already I've been getting emails that there's an all-male panel to kick us off, but I promise there's a method to that madness. So my gay view panel today is because this month is LGBTQ Pride Month, and right now our New York brothers are celebrating in New York Gay Pride, and since our government doesn't recognize this month, we figured take any opportunity that you can to do it elsewhere. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce my guest panelists for the first Meet the Hollywood Press. To my left, James Vaughn, host of Celebrity Page, also a contributor on The Talk, and Access, and I'm sure there's like...
Anybody else who will hire me, I am there. If your check cashes, I will show up.
Oh, God. Welcome, James. Also, Itai Hodd, senior entertainment reporter at The Wrap. Welcome, Itai.
Thank you.
And Gil Robertson, the president of the African American Critics Association.
Hello.
Welcome, Gil. He is also a frequent contributor to BET, and I also was reading online. I mean, you've wrote for LA Times, you've wrote for the Big East. Mm-hmm. So welcome, all three of you. Happy Pride, and welcome to all the viewers and listeners today. With that being said, we're going to jump right in. So just to give you an idea of what we're talking about today, we're going to talk about Netflix N-word shocker. There was a big situation this week. So the head of PR, Jonathan Friedland, basically was in a staff meeting, and he used the N-word in conversation about, like, using the N-word, okay? So very Reed Hastings, the CEO, sent out a memo at about 12:45 p.m. that day, very detailed memo about, you know, obviously why he was immediately fired. And by the way, Jonathan Friedland was with Netflix as their communications chief for like 6 years. And then previous to that, he was at Disney. The interesting part, and I want to have Gil start us off here, because the interesting debate that was going on was that it was about the context of using that word, even when you're describing uses in comedy, uses in music. Mm-hmm. Give me your first take just when this broke and you sort of read the story and you read the memo. What were your immediate thoughts?
It was a surprise, you know, especially for someone at Netflix. Netflix, at least their forward-facing persona is one of being very progressive and liberal. Mm-hmm. And so I was a little, you know, just slightly shocked.
Yes.
That they had someone in working within that capacity, you know, who would make that type of faux pas, not once, but twice.
Yes.
You know, but, you know.
Itai, what were your thoughts?
My thoughts are, if you're anything along these complexions, don't say the N-word ever, not even in the shower. I think that it was shocking. We were in the newsroom when the news came down, and mm-hmm. it was like, everyone was like, what? Like, not once, but twice. And he said it, the first time he said it was at a sensitivity training. The second time he said it, interestingly enough, was at a meeting with HR to try and explain to him why the first time was such a bad idea, and that's when he used it again.
Yes.
So Netflix had to fire him. There's no other thing they could do. I think it was the right call. But yes, absolutely jaw-dropping.
James, in the context of what happened with Netflix and when you're thinking about the industry as a whole, where we've got investigations going on left and right for Me Too situation, things like that, did you think that this was like a situation where it was like they moved along very hastily, just like ABC with the Roseanne thing? Or were you sort of surprised then when you look at other companies that do these internal investigations and it takes even longer for them to sort of like come to conclusions? Like,
I don't think it's a hasty move when you do it and then you do it again in front of people in the meeting. Yeah. It's like, hey, by the way, in case you missed it while you're investigating it, I'm going to do it again and show you I'm a real jerk. it's that word, I don't understand what else we have to say to white people. To
yeah.
Like, that word is not okay.
Okay.
The thing I can equate it to for us is being a gay man, there's the F word.
But do we feel okay about that as a gay man?
No, no, I feel okay about that.
But I feel it's a double standard for us, like, so you don't think even a gay man should use the F word?
I think there's times with endearment where it works.
Yeah.
Just, you know, I'm from an interracial family. Some of you guys know, I don't think you know.
Yes,
so I grew up with siblings that are different races than me. And so
yeah.
there were times where a word was used adjacent to me.
Yes.
But even I know, like, this is not a word I can use.
Can use.
It's the same thing with the F word. I choose to not use it.
Yes.
Because I feel like if I'm using it, I'm telling other people, hey, it's okay for you to use it too.
Yes.
But I just don't understand. It's 2018. Like, how do you not know that these are not words you can't say?
In the context of Jonathan Freeland in this situation, I mean, like, without any knowledge of actually, but do we think that this was like he wanted to get fired? Because I'm trying to wrap my brain around just like what's going through his head. Because either are you drunk, are you high, or you like what was going on that even it was once, then it was twice, and in a meeting with HR, no less.
I don't think he wanted to be fired, but I think the fact that he used it again sort of speaks to perhaps that he. Maybe the word was part of was something that I don't really know.
Yeah.
But the fact that he used it again is definitely troubling.
Yeah, very troubling. The only thing that could have shocked me more with this story is if he would have taken a page out of Kevin Spacey's book and then would have came out as a gay black man after using the N-word. Because that was really effective. By the way, I molested that guy and I'm gay. That was Kevin's defense.
Yeah, yes. which was not a good look for us.
Went down like a lead balloon.
No.
Yeah.
But Netflix, I hand it to Netflix. I thought Reed Hastings' memo was spot on. And I loved how he even got into sort of the uses of it with rap music and hip-hop music and comedy. And basically it was like, just like you said, no white people should be using
but
the word.
But the fact that apparently a period of time had elapsed between his first use and this follow up with human resources.
Yes.
So I think if he was really making a statement, he should have been out of there the first time.
Agreed. Okay, so moving on from one racist situation to another. So if Roseanne Barr and the rabbi, now, okay, so to back up, this week we found out after Roseanne's original racist tweets, if you are not aware of this story, like the rest of the universe, she sent out a tweet a couple weeks ago about Obama's former advisor, Valerie Jarrett, and that she looked like she was a descendant of the Muslim Brotherhood and Planet of the Apes. Okay. So she subsequently got fired, obviously, and then now we found out the sitcom is moving forward at ABC without her. Still no word, and unless you guys know, they still haven't told us how she's being written out. So
I got some ideas.
Oh, well,
no,
I think we all do. So what hit news, a gift for us on the first Sunday of Meet the Hollywood Press, she went on a telephone call with her former spiritual advisor, who is actually... Itai, you were familiar with Rabbi. Say it so I'm saying it
Rabbi
properly.
Shmuley.
Rabbi Shmuley. And so he's also like known in the celebrity world for, you know, working with several celebrities. Roseanne used to work with him, and now I guess this brought them back together.
Yes, he was also in the White House with Steve Bannon recently when Steve Bannon was still there.
Interesting. So basically she got on the phone after all this happened. It was 2 days after the original tweet, but the audio now just surfaced because he released like a cut transcript. And I just want to play some of the audio really fast of her conversation.
A loud mouth and all that stuff, but I'm not stupid, for God's sake, and I never would have wittingly called any black person say they are a monkey. I never would do that, and I didn't do that. And if people think that I did that, it just killed me. I didn't do that, although they think it did, and if they do think that, I am so sorry that I, you know, was so unclear and stupid. I'm very sorry, but I don't think that. I never would do that.
But you still,
I can't.
But you still regret and don't excuse what you wrote.
Of course. No, I don't excuse it. I horribly regret it. Are you kidding? I've lost everything. And I regretted it before I lost everything. And I said to God, I am willing to accept whatever consequences this brings, because I know I've done wrong. I'm willing to accept what the consequences are, and I do, and I have.
Okay, so coming back in from that here, so just initial thoughts.
She is a good actress. There you go, Roseanne. I almost believed you, girl.
Okay, I honestly, it's interesting you say that because I can't believe I'm even going to sit on my brand new platform and somewhat defend Roseanne Barr. Okay, I have a theory. I feel like, she reminded me of almost like an old, like, senile grandmother or like someone that's not like losing their faculties. Like it was semi sincere to me when I was listening to her song, whether she was half in the bag or on Ambien or whatever else, you know, she was on. Did you think there was any sincerity whatsoever?
I think it was sincere. I mean, she's crying and obviously you feel for her when you hear it, except for one thing. I mean, this would have been a lot more convincing in my mind if she hadn't called Susan Rice an ape also, like, in 2013 or something.
Well, she said she has the balls. I thought she said Susan Rice has, like, gorilla balls or something.
Something
like
along
that.
Those lines still. Yeah. Very adjacent, very too close for comfort. And, you know, it's like, and she got a lot of flack for it at the time.
Yeah.
She should have known better. It's not like she had no idea that this is a controversial thing to say.
Mm-hmm. Again, things white people should not say. You just know that's not something you should say. Like, how are you that ignorant in 2018? I don't get it.
Gil, listening to the audio, what are your initial thoughts?
Too little, too late.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's unfortunate that, you know, she lost her job, you know, so...
She lost everything, actually.
I doubt if she lost everything. Yeah. But, you know, she lost her job, and a lot of the people who are around her also have lost income.
Yeah.
But the fact that ABC has decided to move forward with the show, you know, I mean, hopefully that can yield some sort of positive message, you know, once they go back into production, maybe in some clever way they can address,
yeah,
you know, the situation. Those people who were connected with the show... the crew, the tech guys, mm-hmm. you know, they still are gainfully employed, so that's a plus.
200.
And we should give her credit for that. She had to give up her, you know, she had to give up her residuals. She had to give up her financial stake in this reboot, in this third reboot. That's a good thing that she did. I think it was a good first step forward in terms of atonement, but I think there's a long way to go. I think this interview with Rabbi Shmuley, while fascinating, doesn't take away from what she said and what she's done.
But the interesting thing is, It was taped 2 days after it actually happened. So even that was way before we even knew that a spinoff would happen. The timing of it all, is there a strategy here? Like, does she want back in? Does she want redemption? Does she want to come back to the show?
She's not getting back on that show.
No, she's definitely not getting back
on
that show.
Well, here's the thing. Here's my theory on this. Yeah. I think that her giving up her stake in the show, which allowed these 200 people to keep their jobs and the show to go forward... is something that people are going to remember. And mm-hmm. I think that if they... I don't know how they're going to write her out of the show, but if they don't kill her outright, there is a chance, I think, that down the road, maybe
she
after
she
choke
on a ham sandwich made by an immigrant.
You mean like in the 10th season?
Well, wait a minute. The interesting thing, though, in the article, if you read deeper in the original article about the spinoff, she does retain rights to her character for future spinoffs. Right. So to me, it's like...
So if there are any other spinoffs...
But they have to kill her, so then what? They just sort of...
That's
like,
why I don't think she's going to be killed. And
so
I think she might have some guest appearances.
Behind a wall that is built. Yeah. They will find
right.
her.
And yeah. I think it was a very smart branding moment for her to allow the show to go forward, because that's the only thing that's going to ever allow her to come back as Roseanne on TV and maybe make some money off that character down the road.
I think they should send her away to a loony bin. I mean, I think it's kind of it's kind of fitting, no?
There's a lot of ways you can do it.
Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, why not? I think, though, like, the one thing that I always try to focus on when we do have these conversations, because it's very easy to go in on people.
Yeah.
And so now Roseanne has done a list of things that are not so great.
Yeah.
But now maybe she is making the first step to start to make things right.
Yeah.
And so there has to be some capacity for forgiveness with people. I'm not saying you wipe the slate clean and you say, okay, fine, whatever, we forget it all. But you have to start forgiving people and allow people to learn and change, because people can learn and change. And I mean, I've done it. I know people that have done it. To see my family do it with, like, me coming out and then learning to have gay people and their family, and to the point now that my big brother goes to drag bars. Like, people can learn and change.
And so, hey, what kind of wig you need does to, he wear?
We're going to get there. We're going to get him in there. You just wait. But you have to just remember, like, that people are always constantly learning, and some people learn slower than others. And let's give her, I'm not saying put her back on TV, but she's taken the first step. And so let's have a little bit of...
I think it's going to depend on whether or not she does something with this moment. So she's going to take this moment and turn it into a teachable moment. Meaning, is she going to do some work when it comes to racism? And perhaps in a way giving back to the African-American community after what she's done to earn their apology. It's not enough to say, you're sorry. You have to say, I'm sorry. Here's what I'm going to do to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it depends on if the show's a hit.
Yes.
If the show's a hit and it's generating money... Over time, all could be, a lot of things can happen.
You mean the spinoff?
Which is questionable.
In this town, we've seen everything.
Oh, and Hollywood loves a comeback.
Can I just say something without anyone hating on me? But I just did not think that reboot was funny in the least. And
I
loved
it.
Roseanne.
Okay,
the original.
I really liked it.
Loved it.
Listen, I am one of the people online, because you were saying about, like, letter maker mistakes. Here's the thing. I actually was in vicious threads on social for actually watching the show and saying that I could separate the comedy from, like, who she is. Like, I disagree vehemently with her politics, or at least her politics of 2000, of now. Like, the Roseanne back from the original Roseanne was actually a progressive figure in politics. It just, it's somewhere along, which is why I go back to this thing again. Not a doctor, not, you know, but... I feel like there's more than we know here, because it just feels to me like a decline in, like, mental state. Like, it just, it doesn't
seem...
Well,
we know she's herself talked about her mental health issues. Obviously, this is not, you can't separate the two. Clearly, there are some issues there. I think, I personally watched the show, and I was a big fan of the original. I still think, by the way, that the original series stood the test of time. Still extremely funny today if you watch the reruns. I didn't think unlike Will and Grace, which was able to recapture that magic, right? Because you're watching Will and Grace, speaking of Pride, a wonderful, they were able to go back to that sort of funny, you know, moment that they had, the magic that they were able to recreate that. But here in this instance, I thought... kind of fell flat. I mean, other than the fact that this was a working class Trump supporting family, there wasn't really all that much there that I thought was all that groundbreaking.
But her defense, though, okay, so bear with me for one more second, and I will not continue to belabor this, but her basically defense in this was that when she was referring, there was almost thoughts in her mind that had to do with Valerie Jarrett's stance on the, you know, the politics and the religious war over there. So in my mind, I'm sort of thinking, like, did any of us, I know I have, did you ever just sort of, like, tweet or Facebook something and you're thinking, like, what you're thinking in your head came out in the thought, but it didn't? I don't know why I'm being a Roseanne apologist right now, but I'm just sort of trying to present both sides.
She said even in this interview with Rabbi Shmuley that she is adamant about the fact that she did not know that Valerie Jarrett was black, and that she would have never said that had she known that she was African-American.
Well,
I don't know if I believe
that.
I know, especially if you consider the fact that Valerie Jarrett is probably one of the biggest villains, if you think of the Republican sort of Trump base.
Yeah.
You say the word Valerie Jarrett, it's just like saying the word Susan Rice. Interestingly, she said the same thing about both. So that's why I'm having a hard time squaring that with, I didn't know she was African American, but that's what she claims.
But the Ambien.
The Ambien.
But
her emails.
Yeah. The timing of it is interesting to me, because the rabbi himself did the edited transcript, and then now it's sort of out there on the week after we find out about the sitcom. So you know, the spinoff, excuse me.
So the strategy begins. Again, we've got to wait and see if it's a hit. If it's a hit, then who knows what we're likely to
see. The question is, can the Connors even be funny without
in the
Roseanne?
Wake of the situation.
Or without Roseanne.
You know, James, you're on the talk. Get Sarah Gilbert on the call on the phone.
That's what I'm saying. With Sarah Gilbert as an executive producer, and Sarah was the one that made this reboot
happen.
She made the original Roseanne reboot happen. It was the her do it.
Exactly.
So she knows the magic was there. And I think if you watch that show and you watch all the characters, there are plenty of characters on there that can entertain us without her. And like, hey, we had Wanda Sykes as a writer before. Why can't we bring in Auntie Wanda all of a sudden? And now we have a new character. Can you imagine her energy with that cast? There's a lot of people you could put in that space. It's going to be fine without Roseanne. It's going to be better.
I hope so.
Because you're going to not polarize as many people.
No, you'll get more liberals to sample now. Also, the interesting thing that I said, my theory was, like, if they kill her, have Dan's new post-Roseanne girlfriend be African-American, because I feel like that's kind of poetic.
Love it.
You know, bring a diva on, you know, like, from the 90s. Bring Jack Hay on to play Dan.
I would love that.
No, I think it'd be great.
Also,
I agree with you. Like, with Fuller House, how it was DJ Tanner in the next thing, it's sort of like around Darlene, it could work. I think it could work. They did it on so many shows before.
Darlene is the funniest thing
Sarah's
about
the
that,
ball
show.
On that show.
She's
hilarious.
Period. All of them, I think of all of them, if you watch this reboot, all of them took a little time to get back into their sort of
in their
space and their groove. Sarah Gilbert from the very first moment was right there, just like nothing has happened, nothing has changed.
Do you think Roseanne is beyond redemption for this? Like the way like Bill Cosby became like Bill, to me there's two people in Hollywood anyone agree with. Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby can never, in my opinion, make a comeback.
I think
they're
if
done.
Mel Gibson is not beyond redemption, nobody is not is
exactly
above redemption.
So yeah, so what, well, time's clicking though. How old's Roseanne? I don't even, she's 60-something?
She's in her 60s.
Yeah. Okay,
I'm going to say it's the second half of the 60s, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think there actually could be a road to redemption, kind of to go back to what I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
If she continues to make these steps and then do what you said, teachable moments, and really actually physically do things to show, I've learned my lesson. Let me show you the lesson I've learned so you can learn it as well with me. So, you know, she's the crazy grandma. Like,
I think
everybody
the fact
gives
that
crazy grandma a chance.
I think the fact that she's kept the rights to her character tells you that she thinks she's got a road
she's
to redemption for
redemption.
Sure. Yeah,
it's so interesting because it was like, you're right, Sarah put it all together, and I remember reading like a lot of the press about it where Roseanne was sort of like, when she called her, she said, well, what did John say? He's on board. And she's like, all right, I'll do it. It was like people think she really wanted to do, but it feels like she could have taken or leave it from the start. That's
well, she
my
said
opinion.
She said that she would only do it if Sarah Gilbert would take on all the responsibilities and all the fighting with a network,
yes.
Which told you what state of mind she was. She wasn't like dying to do this. She would be willing to do it under certain conditions.
Yes.
But she sounds from that interview, she sounds like she's definitely not happy about how things transpired.
And so what is any of you on this question who has the answer, what would we need to see her do? Like, does she need to establish like a
– she needs to adopt a black baby.
It's just going to take time. You know, it's going to take time.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, just like Mel Gibson, you know, went away and, you know, started off with an independent – you know, it's a process.
Do we think Mel Gibson is complete – not to get off topic – is accepted back fully? I mean, I still feel like – there's a big contingency that's sort of
well,
like
last
it.
Year they ran an Oscar campaign for him,
right.
so clearly.
Yeah. So you're saying in terms of the insider, the industry,
the
sort
industry
of like
has,
the
has welcomed him back. Yeah. Yes, he's
but
now.
But publicly, yeah. Do we think? Like, I mean, I know he was in Daddy's Home too with Mark Wahlberg, which was like everyone said was hilarious. But
I don't know too many Jews who are dying to work with him.
Well, yeah, certainly not.
Yeah. The thing that always got me is because Jodie Foster supports him, and I actually really respect her, and I think I respect a lot of her views, and there's got to be something she sees in this guy if she goes out on a limb for him still, even to this day.
Yeah, and you got to remember, like, in our everyday life with our friends, we allow people to make mistakes.
Yes.
They learn from
right.
them. So let's let these people learn from them. I'm not saying
okay.
do what you're doing because the behavior is awful, but allow people to learn from it.
But we need
and
Roseanne
by learning
to-
from it, we mean doing Passion of the Christ 2, which was already coming under fire the first time around for its anti-Semitic undertones. That's a good way to come back to Hollywood and show that you've learned
show
a lesson.
Them. Okay, so but we need her to be off social media for a little while.
Yeah,
she
needs
to
take a break.
Go
she
away.
She needs to disappear for a while.
Yeah,
we don't know.
Sure.
She needs a social media diet.
Yes.
Okay, so moving on, guys. This next story, I think I'm more excited about this story than even the other ones just because it's kind of like in the weeds, like media story. But okay, so to give you a little background, and by the way, full disclosure here, because Itai and I both worked with the writer on this piece who basically got eviscerated over the weekend by his former
colleagues
at LA Times. Thank you. So basically, just to give you a little gist of this, so Scott Collins, who was a television reporter at LA Times, just on the heels of this week where LA Times was getting all this press for its reboot, it has local ownership again, they're going to be moving into these high-tech offices, and they're sort of like a lot of the morale is finally, after all these years of it just being such a mess with the owners over there, that there's some hope, you know, and some light at down the end of the tunnel. So basically, then a Columbia Journalism Review published this piece by Scott, and I just, you know, just to give you like a little taste of it, it starts off going, it's called "The Decline and Fall of Entertainment Reporting." Okay, "My journalistic hopes died a little the night I hugged RuPaul." Keeping in mind the writer is a straight white male.
First of all, you just said my goals. So I'm already not with this guy.
No, I mean,
like, that's why already, I got into
he's
this.
He's already crossing off his list.
RuPaul.
I mean, one evening in 2014, I found myself interviewing the namesake of RuPaul's Drag Race for a Los Angeles Times video roundtable with Emmy Vogels.
Lucky.
No slight against the hardworking stars of reality TV, but this sort of softball hosting duty was not one of the reasons I started in daily journalism 25 years ago. The Times needed to say, anyway, it goes on into this whole basically history of at the Times, how it was once like a place of journalism, and then as like the evolution of media started in social media, that all of the entertainment started to be all about Oscar ads and the industry putting all this for your consideration dollars. Suffice to say, Garrett Kennedy, who was his former colleague on Twitter, got a hold of the piece and served him on Twitter. But it just started out that basically it was like, I know the writer of this piece, and this is revisionist, basically, like, because this is like, basically, they were all calling BS on the piece. I was just taken by it because I've never, and you guys can remind me, I've never seen a bigger pile-on on one writer from all of their former colleagues at, like, the place that, like, was so overwhelming that I felt for him because I have always gotten along with Scott personally, but I think this was misinformed. Like, this thing was ill-informed. What are your initial thoughts on
it? I see some of his points, and I'll say this about the whole RuPaul thing. I see why some people are upset about that. I think what he meant to say was just, it wasn't necessarily RuPaul. It's just when you go into journalism, and I've had these issues too, you don't think that that's what you're going to be doing, covering a panel with reality stars.
But
again, no offense to reality stars.
But don't you think that that's what the problem is, though, when journalists get on this sort of... That's why, like, the public hates media right now, because it's like that turn up your nose that, like, RuPaul... Like, it just, to me, it was dripping with condescension and elitism.
But,
like,
you know, I also agree with some of the points. I think that what he failed to realize, what the piece fails to address, is that the model simply changed.
Yeah.
And that the nature of the media today requires certain things. A lot of that has to do with social media and other things. But that, you know, you're right. I don't think any of us, or some of us certainly didn't come into this to focus on some of the things that are focused on. You know?
Yes.
But not to say that we want to be loved here, we want to be above it all, but just that we had other aspirations.
But it's true. I mean, we've had these conversations when you were working, when we were working together, about how, you know, what's the balance, right? Because you have to, you want to cover all the fluffy stuff because it brings in all the clicks.
Yeah.
Right. But you also want to make sure that you're not focused on the 37 times, you know, Kit Harington picked his nose on Game of Thrones. all these listicles that will drive you crazy, but those are the things that drive in the traffic, which, you know, keeps the lights on so you can write the more serious stuff. He is really sort of bashing the whole entertainment journalism as an entity. And what struck me really about this is the timing of it during the Me Too era, where, if anything, we should be commending the Hollywood reporting that's been done on this issue.
Absolutely.
And it's true that the New York Times, he mentions that even that was broken by the New York Times and the New Yorker, not by people in Hollywood. But what he forgot to mention in this piece is, yes, those two initial stories were broken by New York publications, but all the rest of it was people like us going in and breaking the rest of the stories and continuing to report on this movement.
Well, I think that the sort of message he was trying to get at there was that Hollywood didn't report on it because of the for your consideration dollars. You know what I'm saying?
I don't think that's true.
There, it's debatable because I worked at like every trade at this point now, and it's sort of like I don't have any knowledge that that's the case, but there's definitely it's definitely of interest to me that if you looked on any books after the year now that Weinstein was completely off the radar and wasn't there to let, I mean, I'm sure all their books took a big hit during Oscar season. Okay, so you don't know. Let's just put it that way. I to me that's a big question mark about like. I know that Janice, who we also mentioned, Janice Min, my former boss too at The Hollywood Reporter, he did give her props, which I agree with, about that was a bright spot in journalism for entertainment journalism when she took over The Hollywood Reporter. And she did speak out already about how Kim Masters at some point was on to the story. So it's not like they weren't trying to report the Harvey stuff, but it was like more like a matter of like some of the stuff that they had gotten was off the record and it was an off the record conversation and things like that. I think, though, in this particular issue with Scott, because he references 2005, right, when all this show recap fluffy stuff started, I was the I became the deputy entertainment editor at LA Times at that time. I was part of the, you know, evil people that had to get traffic for, you know, the newspaper. And it was like, I just found it to be interesting that it's this either or. Like in journalism today, like, do you not think that a site can, I think a site can have both.
Well, they have to.
Out there. Yeah.
You know, I mean, just as you were saying, I mean, one feeds the other. Without the clicks, you can't pay the bills.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the question is how much of it. And I think there's a right. point to be made that journalism, because of the internet, because of the fact that there are no more deadlines necessarily, right? It's all about feeding the beast and doing it as fast as you can and getting it on the page very quickly. You lose some of the quality, you lose some of the depth, and then you end up with a lot of the fluffy stuff and very little of the serious stuff, which, let's face it, gives you the credibility but doesn't really bring in the money.
The money. Absolutely.
Well, that's what I think the whole problem is that, like, journalism is not – it's a business. So that's when – the news business is a business. So at the end of the day, it's like you have to make money.
But you also have a responsibility to inform, right, and to make sure that you're selling your – let me put it this way. Every time you write one of these listicles, you're selling your reputation a butt, right? You're chipping off a little bit off your reputation in order to get some of that cash. And the question is, are you playing a short game, which is 17 listicles a day, or are you playing a long game, which is, you know, a listicle here and there to get some of that traffic, but to remind people, no, we are a serious – trade, and we're covering this industry from the business perspective, the trades, the culture, what's going on within Hollywood, and not who's divorcing who and who's got the latest, you know, I don't know, line out.
We're James, a source that you can rely on.
Exactly, you know. And like reliable. James, going back to the part though about Garrick, his colleague, like going in on him, because I know you have a very funny sense of humor and able to. A lot of people were putting like gifts of like Wendy Williams, like sipping tea. So the question I pose to you is, how do you feel about though the fact of like airing this kind of stuff, colleague to colleague on Twitter with your peers? Like, what's your feeling on that?
Well, I mean, I feel like it's okay if you're going to put your one story out there, then someone else has a different take on you.
Yes.
They're totally fine to put their story out there as well and let us be able to see both sides. But how old is this guy?
He's got to be in his 50s? Early 40s now. I think early 40s, mid 40s maybe.
It just sounds to me like an angry person that doesn't want to keep up with the times. Like someone when TV came out, like, nah, we're sticking to radio. And then, like, you know, I was like, I want a DVD. No, that's not the world we live in anymore. We live in a world where sometimes the celebs now can... they can get us on the scoop because all I gotta do is go on their Instagram.
They control
and boom,
their message.
It's up there themselves. So, like, get with the program. If you don't like it, switch industries, which I mean, he did. He bounced out and I was gone.
Yeah, he bounced.
So, I love where our industry is going.
I agree.
And that's why I'm in it. I think it's cool and I think it's updated and I think it's new and I'm glad it's not the old school way.
No, I agree. Well, even just because I think it's all turned on its ear, even the way that things can originate on digital and then end up the other way, broadcast this way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's you're right. It's a different world we live in. And I actually fought those battles. Like, I absolutely respect every minute that I had at the LA Times because it taught me so much about journalism. But we had battle scars because it literally was a daily battle of the digital team versus the print veterans. And so this just was basically like all of this version of one reporter's story of all of that evolution. But I just felt like it was just...
But I think it's disingenuous for people, even at the LA Times, to not take any of what Scott is saying completely...
There's definitely some valid points in there.
And I think those arguments are being discussed right now in most newsrooms in America right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How much of the clicks versus how much of the actual real good storytelling. What I would say is the LA Times has done some amazing reporting during the Me Too movement. I think they've broken some... really important stories in the last few years, even with all of the turmoil and the trouble that they've had. And I think that's kind of what's missing out of this story.
See, and in Jared's defense, I mean, Jared is a quality journalist. He has written amazing work for the paper. And just recently did a real good look at the rap culture.
Yes. I read that.
Has done very well. It was a great piece. So in his defense... you know, you're not talking about everyone who works at the LA Times. You know, some of the writers who come to work there, you know, are serious about their craft and want to put their best foot forward.
Yeah.
So
the interesting thing you just said, though, is about the LA Times have broken. But that's the interesting thing is I can rattle off like a New York, like 10 stories right now that New York Times broke or Washington Post, but nothing sticks out in my mind LA Times.
I can tell you
And that's not a slight, I'm being completely honest.
No,
like,
the James Toback was the LA Times. James Franco was the LA Times. Whether you agree with that story or not, it was a very big story.
Well, it's not even a matter of agreeing with it. The girls then reneged. I mean, the GMA, the post-GMA interviews were embarrassing.
Brett Ratner was the LA Times. They also broke that story, a huge story. There were a lot of stories that the LA Times broke throughout the Me Too movement. So I think to say that all they do is fluff all day is
I don't think I don't think they do fluff at all. I think that what they do really well is local coverage. Like, that's never waned. I think and through all of the turmoil with the different ownerships, that's never waned in my view. Okay, yeah. So then moving on from that, we're going to have a little section of the show every week, Trump Talks. Because to not cover Trump even as a Hollywood show is to not exist, in my opinion. So obviously this week, Melania Trump went to visit immigrant children in Texas. Obviously with all the problems we're having with families being separated at the border, and she was wearing I really don't care jacket. So what are your thoughts on sort of all this? Like, is Melania just like a super like PR genius that we don't know what this messaging actually is? Or is this like a bunch of a series of unfortunate events each time?
You guys, Melania is trolling all of us. Like, when this is done and Trump's out of office and he's moved on from his presidency and she can finally speak, she's going to come out and be like, yo, I did this, ha ha. Like, she's playing with it. She's having a great time. This isn't what she didn't sign up to be the first lady. She signed up to, you know, marry this gazillionaire, supposedly. Yeah. And so that's what she wanted to do and be the hot model wife. Yeah. Now she's like, I got to be the first lady. All right, I'm going to have some fun with this. I think she's playing with all of us.
So you think the jacket had nothing to do, the message had nothing to do with anything that was going on currently in this whole debate?
You know, I sort of think that it was a message to him. You know, the fact that she didn't wear it when she got there, and that she did put it back on when she returned, I think that it was some sort of message being sent directly to him. Now, what that message is, I'm not sure.
I think whoever thought of that move should be fired immediately.
Totally.
I mean, I really think that it was one of the worst decisions she could have made, putting on that jacket as she's going to supposedly care about these children who are taken away from their families. Whatever the message was, and she claims, or he claims, that it was to the media, whatever that was, it was ill-conceived and ridiculous, and obviously the optics are terrible. And she just went from someone who, even if you dislike the Trump administration, perhaps you were willing to give her the benefit of the doubt because of the fact that clearly their relationship has been, you know, somewhat questioned.
They're not up to inherit.
Yes, but this sort of puts her in that same category as him because of the tone-deaf message that jacket had on.
But I thought by her going to visit the children, wasn't that trying to say, like, I'm breaking from my husband on this?
What did we talk about? All we talked about was that jacket. Yeah. So even that took away from everything she did that day. And, of course, the first thing that she asked when she got there is, how can I help you? And my first thought was, how about you talk to your husband? Who do I need to call? Your husband.
I don't think she wants to talk to you. They talk through each other, probably through
what can I do to help you? I don't know. Maybe you can talk to the man you're married to.
Does anyone think, does the smallest possibility that it was just an accident and everyone was unaware?
No.
She's
no,
much
she doesn't,
too attuned.
She doesn't buy her.
I'd say I thought.
It's not like she goes to Zara and looks at a jacket and picks it up. And
right.
Goes, this is something that had to be brought to her. She had to either ask or buy it. Or this was a decision that
maybe
was done by more
was
than one person.
Her. Who knows?
I was actually surprised she wears Zara.
She has a team.
Good for
actually,
her. Stars. They're
I mean,
just
no,
like
think,
us.
I think it's great. Okay. It's
you guys.
Really?
No, she I'm has a team of people.
This is the same company that had Pepe the Frog on their skirt jeans and had to cancel that. Remember that whole
yes,
story?
Yes, I do remember
yes,
that.
Yes, this is not a company that I think no one's ever talked about this. But the fact that she picked Zara, of all things, has to be questioned because that company has a history of anti-Semitic clothing. Mm. They also had a whole line of remember the line that looked like you came out of Auschwitz?
No.
Yes, that they had to cancel that line because some people, they put it next to like a uniform from like the World War II from the concentration camps and it was exactly the same.
Oh my.
This is a company that's had several very questionable sort of items on display and now this,
The jacket sell out? Did it sell out? That's the thing.
She should be getting residual.
Maybe it was a
maybe they're going to announce the contract this week.
Yeah, it's like those people that get paid to post on Instagram. That was her paid post.
Oh my God.
Hashtag ad. Go on, Melania.
Okay, so moving on from that, this is actually even more delicious. So, everyone's favorite press secretary in the world, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, announced via Twitter that she had been asked to leave the Red Hen restaurant in Virginia just because she works for Trump, which, I mean, I want to meet the owner of the restaurant personally, but what
do you know why she said she did that, right? Speaking of gay pride, said she did that because of the fact that she didn't like the way the administration has dealt with the LGBTQ community.
Yes.
So it was in direct relation to that.
And she has several gay employees there.
Yeah.
But although... Okay, so wait. But that gets into this... I feel... Let's start for first question, though. Do you feel that this was in the right? That this is just refusing service to a person?
Potentially, it's problematic.
Yes, agreed.
The statement that it yields right now is great, it's funny, but I think in the long run, you know, it sets a precedent that could potentially be dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And abused, you know.
I think that would have carried a little more water if they hadn't already done that with a gay community. Meaning you can't complain about... you know, when she was asked, I think it was in December, right after the first hearings on the Supreme Court case with a bakery, she was asked whether she'd be okay with a sign that said, no gays allowed, because that was sort of what was going to happen if this went forward. And she said, yes, she would be okay with that. So you can't complain that you can't say a restaurant can refuse service to people based on their moral sort of beliefs on one hand, but when it comes to you, I mean, this is the same thing, right? If you think about the equivalence here, you're refusing service for someone based on moral background, right? On a moral issue.
It's
what's the difference?
It's very much pot kettle black. I mean, it really is. Like, there's a lot of hypocrisy in this. But the thing, to target back to like what I learned with my family, people can learn and change. I think there was a missed opportunity for possibly a dialogue there.
Yes.
That I'm not saying it would have been a good one because she doesn't seem in those press conferences to want to have a dialogue, but maybe she could have, and she is a mom. Maybe they could crack through and find a little bit of heart in there. So there was a missed opportunity there that instead just turned into a chance for Sarah to, you know, rile up her supporters while the people on the other side get to rile up too.
Which it's working because the Yelp page is like littered with one star reviews. However, I believe that the Trump administration probably called up the Russian bots
to
go.
They had to it down because of that, because all the Trump supporters weighed in. But I can tell you this. First, two things. One, there's another Red Hen, I think, in New Jersey that came out saying that because they got so many calls, because everyone thought that they were the one. And they were like, no, you can come and eat here. So clearly not everyone's on board with that policy. Yes. But the other thing I think is interesting is the fact that she said in that tweet how she always... treats everyone with respect, even if she disagrees with them, right? That's what she said in the tweet. And then I think it was someone who responded to her on Twitter and said just the quote that she said to Jim Avalon when she said to him, oh, for people who you can't even understand short sentences or something. Remember that sort of obnoxious thing she said
to
him?
Yeah, to the CNN.
So someone should just responded to her with that line with that. To show her that that's not exactly true.
She just needs a little love. Like, look at her. That's a sad face. She just needs a little love. It's, but I'm telling you, there's opportunity. Remember, she got compared to, and I'm not saying it, but she got compared to Aunt Lydia from Handmaid's Tale.
Yes, she did.
Well, spoiler alert, if you haven't watched it yet, there's starting to be little cracks in Aunt Lydia that maybe there's some heart and love in there.
Right.
Maybe Sarah's going to come out and she's going to be the savior of us all. Who knows?
We hope so.
Yeah, that's a mama. That's somebody's mama. You got to remember that somebody, it's okay, Sarah. She just needs love. I'm going to hug her. I'm going to hold her tight.
Oh, my God. Okay, so now we are going to move to something where we're going to call this segment every week Overheard Hollywood, where I'm going to give my panelists an opportunity to just tell us something you're hearing, something you're working on or have worked on, but something that our audience would be interested in knowing about the week to come or something last night, maybe at an event, anything.
Scoop us, fellas. What you got?
Yeah,
I can only give you like a little hint about what I'm working on.
Yes.
But I can't give you too much, but it's going to be another look on the whole Me Too movement from a different perspective and perhaps the...
Is it still going on?
It's still going on. Yes. It's absolutely still going
on. No, I mean, I say that with love because I feel like it's like... Anyway, that's a whole nother show.
The hope is that it's not going to stop going on. That's really the hope.
Good. We hope. We hope so, too.
So we're going to be working on just a look at the Me Too movement, perhaps at the also the negative sort of consequences of the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
So that's something that I'm going to be working on.
You're working on that. Okay. Gil?
Well, at AFCA, at the African American Film Critics Association, we're having a summer screening series. We screened Coming to America on Monday. It was the 30th anniversary of that title.
30. Wow.
And in July, we're going to be screening Poetic Justice.
Love this.
With director John Singleton. It's the 25th anniversary of that title.
Oh, my God.
And regarding Me Too, expect a major announcement at Toronto regarding a PR toolkit to sort of increase the way that entertainment publicists in general, identify and work with journalists across the board.
I like that. And does that have anything to do with Time's Up, or this is specifically Me Too?
It's Time's Up.
Okay, got it. And James?
Well, you know, Celebrity Page, we love to focus on the positive side of celebrity news.
Oh, yes, you sure do, yes.
And getting to work with Julie Chen at The Talk, obviously I'm very excited about the new season of Big Brother that's coming out.
Okay, right on.
You see, Julie's been posting all this stuff from inside the house, all
I was
new
looking,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Even like the little thing with the dog filter.
Yeah.
So I guess people, when they're missing their phones and missing their dog filter, they can put that
up.
Like they're getting their fix. So I'm so excited. Wednesday night, that starts.
Okay.
And Julie's excited about it, and seeing how excited she is about it has got me so excited. I didn't watch it until I met Julie.
Are you on The Talk this week?
I was just on this past
week.
You're
just on this past week. Okay, got it. Okay. Well, that about wraps it up, guys.
Access Hollywood tomorrow, though.
Free plug.
Shameless plug alert.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, guys, thank you for joining me today. Happy Pride again. And thank you to all the viewers for tuning in. And join us next week when these three seats are filled with another three journalists as we tackle Hollywood.
Not nearly as handsome as us.
Thank you. Take care.
That's all. Love, Sarah. Come on.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.